You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So in today's episode, I'd like to talk about something that we probably all do on social media. At least I just don't think I'm the only person. So I feel like one of the things that social media is really good for is checking in on our nemeses or our enemies. So we will log on to whatever platform it is. And I feel like part of the reason why we're looking at people we used to know's profiles is to gauge how they're doing in their lives, not just out of like sheer innocent curiosity, at least not in my case, but because we're trying to find out if like they're still doing well. So every now and again, I'll think of somebody who I used to work with who did me wrong, or a boss who was terrible to me, or a former friend who did me dirty. So maybe I'll go onto LinkedIn to look at the colleague, and I will be like annoyed or irritated to see that they're doing well in their career. Like they've got a good job. They've probably received a couple of promotions since I last saw them. They're posting articles that they've written or participated in or contributed to. So in other words, like they're doing fine. Or if it's like somebody in my personal domain or personal sphere, I might log into Facebook and I will go to look at their profile. I'll look at their pictures. I'll look at like the things that they post. And I again will be irritated because I will see that they're clearly thriving. So maybe they've gotten married. Maybe they've just started a family. Maybe they've just bought a house. Or even if it isn't like these big milestones, like you will see clearly that they're, you know, doing well in life, that they're doing okay. So you'll see them at dinner. You'll see them out at bars and clubs with friends. You'll see them taking like trips and holidays. And I will think to myself, like, how long will it be until this person gets what's coming to them? Like, how long until the world or cosmic justice gets them in some way? And then that will, of course, invariably make me start thinking about the concept of karma and the concept of there being a heaven and hell. And if you haven't come across like karma before, it's a simple notion. I mean, I say simple, there's a whole philosophy around it, but if I had to give it to you in a sentence, it's the idea that your good and bad actions will come back and affect you, and that they follow you through all the lives that you have. So people believe in karma, also believe in reincarnation, the idea that you die and your body may die in this life, but you are born again as somebody else. And so what happens with karma is that when you are reborn, because your soul follows you from body to body, the consequences of your actions follow you in preceding lives, essentially. And that means that you can't escape the badness of a previous life through death. And then with heaven and hell, it's slightly different in that there isn't like this notion of being born multiple times. So it's not as though the same soul is born in different bodies, like over the course of many lifetimes. It's more that you can live life as you choose right now. You can choose to be a good person or a bad person and do good deeds or bad deeds. But if you don't repent when you've done bad things, then you are going to suffer in the afterlife. And that afterlife happens to last an eternity. So there's no finality and there's no end to it. So basically good people are lucky in the sense that they get to enjoy happiness and joy and peace, etc., forever. But the people who've done bad things are punished in like an unimaginable way, in the sense that they don't just suffer for like a year or two, they suffer for all of eternity. So slightly different interpretations, but basically the same concept, in the sense that like things are going to catch up with you. Like you can't escape bad deeds. Bad deeds, people who do bad things are going to be punished when all is said and done. Now, on a basic like human level, that idea or those philosophies are really satisfying, in particular the karma one, because for me it feels more immediate and more like believable, I guess you could say. And so the idea that somebody who has done bad things, or has done me dirty, or has done the world dirty in some way, is going to get their just dessert, it's satisfying for so many levels. One, there's like retribution for bad things that have been done. And second, like that person's going to be taken down a peg or two because they're going to be punished for the things they've done. And then three, I don't need to consume myself with like the negative emotions that are associated with feeling like injustice has been done to you. I don't need to be consumed with frustration or hopelessness or anger, because I know that they're going to get what they deserve, and what they deserve is a bad thing because they've done bad things. So I want to believe in both those concepts of karma and heaven and hell, from that just basic human desire to not feel like somebody has gotten away with doing bad things to me. But when I think about it deeply, like both those concepts philosophically break down pretty quickly. Now, the first reason they break down quickly for me is like, we can all observe that bad things happen to good people all the time. And those bad things are happening to those good people, not because they deserve it or they've done anything bad or anything worse than anybody else. It just happens to be the luck of the draw or the way the cookie crumbles. So like when you think of cancer, people get cancer every day. And it's not just elderly people who are more likely to get cancer the longer they live. It's also really young people. You'll have like children, you'll have toddlers, you'll have teenagers, you'll have people in their early 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s who are getting cancer and other like life-threatening illnesses. And it isn't because they have led their lives in a particularly bad way or any different to anybody else. It's just the luck of the draw. They happen to be unlucky. Sometimes it's for for environmental reasons. They might have grown up in poverty and lived in buildings, for example, where they're breathing in mold all the time, or they might have lived in places where it's a food desert and they've been consuming like toxic food all their lives unbeknownst to them. It might be because they use products that have poor regulation for all kinds of reasons, and those products have contributed to their cancer. So again, it isn't because they're bad people. It isn't because they're getting their just desserts. It's just the luck of the draw. So for me, believing in karma would also imply believing that those people have done something wrong or have done something to deserve those things. And I think that's an ugly belief to have. Outside of bad things happening to good people, it is also obvious that bad people don't get punished for their sins. And that happens all the time. So you can think of like major like public figures like Jeffrey Epstein, who was literally a lifelong villain. And after abusing literally hundreds, if not thousands, of children and women, he literally got off scot-free. He never saw the inside of a jail for the majority of his crimes. And then he got to escape the final time he was convicted. He got to escape by committing suicide. So he was able to offend for like 50 years, as well as like his buddies, by the way. Like Bill Gates is still living free and enjoying his freedom, despite the fact that we now know that he was heavily involved with Jeffrey Epstein over the course of many years. Same with people like the Bill Clintons of the world and all these other like wealthy, famous people who visited Epstein's island and his homes in New York for many, many years. All these people like are still living free. Actually, in the UK, I just remembered how Prince Andrew, the son of Prince Charles, who's now the head of the monarch, I just remembered how like public finances were used to pay off one of his accusers, this woman called Victoria, who alleges that he violated her when she was still a young woman. I think she was like 18 at the time. So he has now been socially and publicly disgraced, but he still has his millions. So even though he can't perform like public duties anymore and he can't show up to parties in a loud way, he's still allowed to attend those parties, one. And secondly, he still has access to like all the land that his family owns, all the wealth that has accumulated to the royal family. So again, like literally able to escape negative consequences of his actions. So in that context, of bad people not getting punished all the time for their sins, you know, again, the idea that karma is real breaks down pretty quickly. Another thing is, we know that bad people are remembered as good people all the time, which is one of the things that drives me absolutely crazy. One of the figures that I always think about under this umbrella is Mother Teresa. And she's one person who's literally revered for being the personification of what it means to be a good person, to be a pious person, to be a self-sacrificing person, to be like a holy person, quote unquote. And the thing about Mother Teresa is that she was actually a very evil woman in many, many respects. You should read BTW, The Missionary Position by Christopher Hitchens, which is an all-time favorite book of mine. And what that book details, and other biographers and other historians have chronicled, is that, for example, one of the things that she did that makes her like an evil human being was she would often like receive huge funding from like governments, from private donations, from like wealthy individuals. And she would use this in a way that can only be described as being at the very least malicious. One example of this is when she was gifted a homelessness center. So this was like a state-of-the-art center in which it had like multiple rooms with good beds, like brand new everything, brand new beds, brand new furniture, had central heating. It had like really good facilities, and it was designed to basically have homeless people have like the space that was dignified, that was safe, that was warm, that was comfortable. And what she did like from day one was that she took out all the beds and mattresses and threw them away so that the people who lived in that facility had to sleep on the floor. She also had them remove the central heating so that it was never warm, it was cold. And then she also didn't use the money to like make the people's lives more comfortable. And the reason for this was that she believed that suffering brings people closer to God. And so she didn't want people having access to heating or having beds or having furniture or having all these other facilities that the money was designed for, because she believed that it's only through experiencing like suffering and torture, essentially, that they would be closer to God. Other things that she did was that she operated in Bangladesh and India, for example, and she would make giving people food and shelter and medication conditional on them converting to their religion. So she would say, like, you can have all this food, you can have like a warm place to sleep at night, you can have a safe place to sleep at night, you have access to medication, but the only way you can get that medication is if you accept the Lord and Savior into your life, which is evil, especially in the context of she was operating in a country where the predominant religion wasn't Christianity, it was Hinduism. So they would have to abandon their own faith in order for them to get the help that they needed. Other things that I think about Mother Teresa is how she was not trained, and I always talk about this, about people who aren't qualified in specific domains being able to operate in those domains just because they're famous. So I've talked about it in the context of Bill Gates, for example, going around developing countries, speaking on public health issues when he has no training whatsoever in public health or medicine or healthcare, or other people like Elon Musk, being part of the government and controlling what kind of government programs get funding and what don't, when he has no training and has not been elected to do so. Mother Teresa was the same in her own sphere, in that she was a nun with no medical training. She wasn't a nurse, she wasn't a doctor. And somehow she was going around in poor countries administering healthcare, administering medication, treating people when she had no qualifications whatsoever. And what ended up happening, of course, was that people would get... One, she was using syringes and needles that weren't sanitized between each use. So she would go and inject one person with a needle that she'd used on another person without sanitation. And what naturally happened is that diseases were spreading because she didn't understand the basic concept of sanitization. Another thing she did was that she prevented people from having access to painkillers. And people would be writhing around in complete... pain and discomfort, and she would withhold that kind of medication because she believed that, again, suffering brought people closer to God. So again, it's an example of people who did bad things, who were clearly bad people, but history doesn't define them in that way, because the propaganda machine that surrounded people like Mother Teresa has upheld her as a saint. In fact, she has been canonized and she is a saint now. You can also look at the way that we remember the founding fathers. So despite the fact that they all exclusively or explicitly were slave drivers, they are literally never remembered in those terms, in the public domain at least. Like when you see them on the back of like money, like the back of coins or notes, it's not as though you see like founding father and slave driver or founding father and sex trafficker, it'll just say their good deeds. It'll ignore like the terrible deeds that's also attached to their names. Same with other like famous political people or business people like Cecil Rhodes, who was like personally responsible for the deaths of thousands of African men and women in South Africa during the apartheid regime. Like, he still has grants at Oxford University in the UK under his name. He still has statues dedicated to him. Literally the same thing as the founding fathers. Like, there's no recognition of the fact that this person was a vile human being. So again, not only do bad people not get punished for their bad actions, but also history ends up remembering them as good people for eternity, essentially. The other reason why I find it difficult to believe in karma is that even outside individuals doing bad things, we also know that the institutions that do terrible things end up enduring. One of the institutions I often think about is the Roman Catholic Church in particular. And having grown up in Ireland, one of the things that, you know, we always learned in school was the legacy of the Magdalen Laundries. And the Magdalen Laundries were basically these asylums where women who had been deemed as having fallen, quote unquote, were sent to live, usually for the rest of their lives, although there are cases where they were able to leave eventually. And to be described or qualify as a fallen woman, you basically had to have had like a child out of wedlock, or having turned to prostitution to make a living, or having been deemed as not being socially respectable or upholding the moral standards of the Catholic Church. And so women would be shipped away to these asylums, never to be heard from again. And whilst they were at these asylums, like, their lives were literally hell on earth. So not only were they subject to like psychological and emotional abuse, where they were called all kinds of things and made to feel as though they were worthless people because they had had sex or because they had had children, even sometimes, by the way, when those children were a consequence of rape, they also were forced to endure extremely difficult physical labor from like the early morning to the late evening. They often weren't allowed to sleep for very long periods of time at all, so they might get like 6 hours of sleep a night. They also were forced to give up their children. Their babies were put up for adoption. I know that many adoptions now mean that the children and the parents can find each other like later on, like once the child turns 18. But back in those days, they were blind adoption, which meant that the mothers had no hope of ever finding their children because they didn't know either the name of the child or where the child ended up at. And often, by the way, these adoptions were against the consent of the mothers because the babies were taken away from them. And outside them being subjected to forced labor, having little sleep, them being emotionally and psychologically abused, they also endured a great deal of physical abuse. So one of the things that shocks me the most when I think about it is how violent like these nuns that ran these institutions were. Like, they would beat them senseless for the most like trivial infractions. And clearly they like got some kind of sadistic satisfaction from torturing these women. I know that the Irish government in the early 2010s like issued a state apology for what had happened like in the Magdalen Laundries, and they had said that they were going to give like the survivors or their families some money, but I don't know if that actually materialized. But still, whether they got that money or not, it's not as though that apology erases the suffering that these women and their families endured. And top of that, it's not as though the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church in Ireland, ever faced any consequences. So, for example, consequences might have looked like those nuns getting convicted or not being allowed to practice anymore. But neither of those two things ever happened. Another example I think about when I think about the Roman Catholic Church is their scandal around pedophilia. Now, we all now make jokes about like priests being pedos. And the reason why that's like a common joke is because we now know how widespread that practice was, how many priests were involved in how many different countries and how many different churches. And most shockingly of all, how the church at the time knew that it was happening, and instead of them bringing the priests to justice or kicking them out of the Roman Catholic Church or bringing them to the police and having them arrested, they basically turned a blind eye to it. And when the public scandal in their local communities became too large, or too big, they just moved the priests around to different locations. Like, the bigger the scandal, the further away the priest was sent. So a lot of priests, for example, ended up in Latin American countries or African countries, places essentially where their like seedy past and their seedy practices could be erased and forgotten, and they could continue presumably doing what they were always doing in those places. When it comes to institutions, I also think about banks and insurance firms who have profited from slavery and colonization. And these are like major international banks. Like, when you think about banks like Barclays or HSBC or Lloyd's, these organizations have been around for a few centuries, at least like two or three centuries. And they, all the ones I've just listed and many others, directly profiteered from slavery, not just indirectly because the slave drivers or colonizers were banking their money with them, but they also financed or owned assets, quote unquote, that were directly tied to colonization and slavery. An example is, for example, many of them owned plantations in which slave labor was used, or they bought companies that looted like African countries, for example, during colonization. And over time, they were able to whitewash that money so that you can't tell easily, unless you go looking for it, where the origins of the money came from. So the money that was used to found and continue and to run these businesses. So again, even in that area, when I think about karma, the idea that people who do bad things don't benefit in the long run because their actions catch up with them. When you look at these institutions, whether it be the Roman Catholic Church or the banking industry, like I just spoke about, they've been around for a very long time, and they've been around and thriving. And although like the people who ran those organizations like die and new people take over, often these things are very hereditary. Like it results in generational wealth. When you consider people who come from famous banking family, it's not as though that money that was the outcome of slavery or colonization doesn't benefit future generations. It still benefits their descendants. It benefits their children, their grandchildren, their extended family members. And it's on that basis that they're able to accumulate even more power and even more wealth. So again, karma obviously isn't affecting like these people, and it isn't affecting these institutions. And not only that, but they're able to even benefit from their actions in the future. So, you know, that was like a handful of reasons why, even though I want to believe in karma and I want to believe in the idea of there being cosmic justice, I ultimately find it very difficult to believe in light of like these five things that I just spoke about. Now, moving on to my next section, which I wanted to talk about, was how I think that believing in these concepts has like a negative effect on us. I think the first way is that it kind of makes us passive and makes us accept like injustice in a passive way. And by that, I mean that, like, if you believe in a fundamental way that people end up reaping the consequences of their actions, and that they end up like experiencing harm or poor luck or just generally like bad conditions or bad situations because of the things they've done, then the flip side of that is that you also necessarily have to believe that people's like current suffering right now, at least in a segment of the population, is a direct result of their past actions. So you have to believe that the reason why they are experiencing a bad situation or poor luck or negative experiences is because they deserve it in other words, like they did something in a past life that warrants their current situation. Now, I know most of the time we don't explicitly think of it in that way, but it's kind of implied in what we say and what we think, because that's the flip side of believing that when people do bad things are going to happen to them. It also must imply that bad things that are happening to people right now is a consequence of the bad things that they've done. It's a consequence of their own karma catching up to them, essentially. Obviously, not only is this like not true, it's also, again, like an ugly thing to believe. And it makes us be passive in the face of suffering, because if we believe in karma, we kind of think on some level they deserve it. And this can be seen in like lots of like really subtle ways. And like one of the areas where this is evident is homelessness. And with homelessness, I genuinely feel that the majority of people are able to not be emotionally moved by it, by believing that the homeless people did something to deserve that homelessness. So often they'll tell themselves stories about how it's because of like rampant drug addiction or poor life choices that have led people into experiencing homelessness. In other words, they've done something to deserve it, like through their actions, through their choices, they've done something to deserve the homelessness they're experiencing. When the reality of the matter is that the majority of people on the street are not drug addicts, they haven't done drugs, they're not alcohol addicts, they're not there because of that, they're not there because of any actions they've taken. Most Americans are literally only one crisis away from homelessness themselves. So imagine somebody like a middle-class family, like experiencing illness in the family, like somebody gets an illness like cancer or an illness that requires expensive treatment and expensive and long-term healthcare, then especially in the context of knowing that most Americans don't have any savings and they're only one paycheck away from being on the street, being struck with a healthcare crisis that requires all this money to treat it, especially if it's a long-term illness, results in people becoming homeless or people living in insecure living situations where there is no caps on rents, for example. There is no legislation to prevent landlords from kicking them out with very little notice if they fail to pay their rent. All these systems are in place that mean that people are very vulnerable to homelessness. So when we believe that people deserve their condition or have done things that warrant their current situation, it also makes us believe things that make us less compassionate and make us be passive in the face or in the presence of suffering. And this is actually very topical because one of the things that the Trump administration has said they're going to do is that they are, one, further entrenching legislation against homelessness, which effectively means that homeless people are being banished from the streets. They have nowhere to go and they've been told to make themselves invisible, to disappear from cities. And he has suggested that what he plans to do is have an encampment. So he's going to buy tracts of land outside like major cities and have them all be sent there for quote unquote retraining. And for, he essentially, like, it sounds like conversion camps, like he's going to send them there and they're going to have to undergo this reprogramming to make them, I guess, like not be homeless anymore. And then if they are able to successfully pass through these programs, then they are going to be released again. In practical terms, obviously this is not going to happen because, again, you can't program people or teach people not to be homeless because the reasons why they are homeless in the first place is not a consequence of their actions. It's a consequence of poor luck and a consequence of government policies that doesn't protect them and keep them off the streets or makes it very difficult for them to be in supportive housing or housing provided for people who are homeless because there's so many conditions attached, like they have to agree to be separated from their children, or they can't bring pets, or they can only be there under very strict conditions. So having this encampment where they undergo this retraining or teaching or programming doesn't even make sense in the context of the reasons why people are homeless. And on top of that, because it's being approached with like such lack of compassion and understanding, it's unlikely that the fruit of that are going to be positive or successful. So again, like, an example of the negative consequences of like beliefs that seem on the surface benign, but like when you dig a bit further, they actually have really negative consequences. Another reason why I think it's unhelpful or even detrimental to believe in the concept of karma or even the concept of heaven and hell or in general the concepts of cosmic justice is I think often they focus on like moral, personal responsibility or the responsibility you have over your own morality, and that is prioritized over the idea of collective action. So when you think about karma and when you think about the concepts of heaven and hell, they each emphasize that the way for us to have good lives, either in this life or the next or in the afterlife, is by focusing on us doing good things ourselves. Like if we ourselves are good people and do good things and have good thoughts, then we're going to be rewarded by good things happening to us now or good things happening to us in the future. And this like hyperfixation on the self, on individual morality, can basically divert us from systemic issues that don't or aren't solved by focusing on yourself, but can only be solved collectively or through organized collective action. An example of this is the climate emergency. So despite what the Republican Party is saying, despite what climate deniers are saying, it's quite clear that the negative consequences of greenhouse emissions have caught up to us. And the response is often focused on changing consumer behavior, changing individual consumer behavior. So a lot of focus is placed on things like not using plastic straws. So when you go to a bar, they've replaced the plastic straws with like either cardboard straws or sometimes metal straws if you go to like a diner or something. Or the focus on making sure that we recycle at home and recycle at our institutions. So making sure you've got the blue bin. Here in the UK, the blue bin is for paper and like recyclable waste, and the green one is for like garden waste, and the black one is for trash that can't be recycled. And then we have that same system in our schools and our places of work. And also there's a great emphasis on not littering and making sure that we buy things that are sustainable. So instead of buying like a plastic bottle, buy a glass bottle. And all of these individual actions are a reflection of us taking moral responsibility for the climate emergency, but they ultimately are almost like a distraction from what is actually happening. Because if we were to add up the sum total of our individual isolated actions towards the climate emergency, they honestly are not going to be enough. And that is for the very simple reason that consumer behavior actually represents like the smallest section of what is contributing to greenhouse emissions and to the emergency, to the climate emergency. When you look at the data, we see that since 1988, and this is a research conducted by Manchester University, and it's also just widely known, but if you look at greenhouse emissions since 1988, 100 companies are responsible for 71% of all global greenhouse gas emissions. So 100 companies responsible for 71% of the emergency. If you can break it down even further, and you can see that actually of those 100 companies, only 25 of them are responsible for more than 50% of all greenhouse gas emissions. What that tells us is that if 100 companies are responsible for 71% of the emissions, what is individual consumer behavior going to do? The focus should clearly be on collective action in peer pressuring and lobbying the government and incentivizing the government to regulate these 100 companies at least, because even regulating just these 100 companies would go a long way into resolving or contributing to the reduction of the climate emergency. So again, it doesn't matter how much we individually compost or make sure we throw away our trash in the right bins. It's only through this collective action that this problem is going to be solved. I think also what the climate emergency shows us indirectly is the very fact that karma can't be real, in the sense that we are experiencing the climate change that past generations caused. It's not as though we were around for the Industrial Revolution, or we were part of the people who are emitting all these greenhouse gases or wrecking the environment or causing destruction to our environment, essentially. Yet we still are the people who are negatively impacted, especially like future generations. Like, we're getting off light, but people who come after us are going to experience even more extreme weather disruptions and shortages in food and all these unexplained, I mean, they are explained, all these negative consequences and fallout from what we've done to the environment. And again, it's not because we or they deserve it. It's just a function of having essentially been born at the wrong time. And talking about the environment always makes me think about Extinction Rebellion, who are this really active group in the UK. They might have like international branches too, it's probably likely. But they organize non-violent resistance towards like in service or in protest of the climate emergency and the lack of government action around it. And some of the things that they do is like they'll glue themselves to the side of planes so that the planes can't take off. Or they'll glue themselves onto airplane runways. Or they'll dive into rivers and not let like ships pass, just like really outlandish stuff. But I really admire the work that they do, because it's an example of not deferring action to some cosmic justice system where the world is just going to punish the people who do bad things, like autonomously without the inter intervention by people. Like, they take matters into their own hands and they do something about it in a way that affects change. And I think, again, like, one of the negative consequences of believing in karma, or believing in the idea that people are either punished by a divine order or by, like, the cosmic justice that comes through karma, is that it makes you, like, really passive to the situations or negative things that are happening in the here and now, because you ultimately can wash your hands of those things, because you say to yourself, well, the world will solve these issues, or cosmic justice will solve these issues, or these people who are responsible for these harms or for this evil will be punished in an afterlife. Either way, like, it doesn't solve the problems of now. The final thing I'd like to talk about under the umbrella of what I think the negative harms that accrue from believing in cosmic justice of all forms, whether it's karma or heaven and hell, is that I think they often involve the suppression of righteous anger and outrage. And the reason for that is very simple. Like, if you ultimately believe that karma is going to get people who do bad things, then inherent or implied in that is the idea that you shouldn't take justice into your own hands. You shouldn't try and get retribution. You shouldn't try and get the scales of justice, if you will, to be rebalanced in your favor, because these people are going to be punished in the long run. That's the same thing as well with believing in an afterlife where evil people or people who do bad things are punished for an eternity. It implies that you should show forgiveness and you should turn the other cheek in the here and now, and you should accept hardships in the here and now, because ultimately the people who are doing bad things and the people who are responsible for the hardships that you face are going to get what's coming for them. They're going to be punished eventually. And the reason why that is so problematic is that it means that you allow injustice to prevail. You ultimately let things go that you shouldn't let go, because one, things have a knock-on effect. Like, sometimes it isn't for you to forgive, because when you forgive, it means that institutions, for example, that do terrible things every day continue to operate in exactly the same way because they don't face the consequences of their actions, or the representatives of those institutions don't face the consequences of their actions. One of the things that I honestly makes me so sad is whenever there is a police shooting of a black person or a person of color, usually a black person, I have to say, there'll be a press conference where the family is understandably incredibly emotional. But then, because mostly, like, fueled by their religion that encourages them to turn the other cheek, they will make statements about how they forgive the police officer that shot their family member. And this is in spite of the fact that the police officer has not been found guilty of the crime, has not been charged. They're often like allowed to take paid leave. They often are found not guilty by the jury, despite, like, footage of them doing whatever they've been accused of. And then also, like, 9 times out of 10, these police officers never ask for forgiveness. They don't ask the family for forgiveness. They don't issue an apology. They don't say that they are ashamed for what they did or that they regret their actions. And yet here the family often is so quick to forgive them. And that forgiveness, I understand, comes from them wanting to not hold on to anger, because anger is a very consuming emotion. But I also think that anger is one of the most powerful motivating emotions, because it's self-sustaining. There are other emotions that aren't self-sustaining. Like, for example, I don't think motivation itself is self-sustaining. It depends on the day and how you feel that day. I don't even think compassion is self-sustaining, because often we choose, like, selfish desires over like doing the right thing or doing the compassionate thing. Or kindness is fickle as well, because it depends on your mood. It depends on the social capital you get from that kindness. It depends on all kinds of things. So it's not as sustaining and reliable as anger. Personally, I think anger, and you will know this from your own experiences of being angry about it, the thoughts will consume you. You will think about things. You will ruminate on things. You will want to do something consistently and for a prolonged period of time about that negative thing that has happened to you. And when channeled properly, when channeled through activism, when channeled through taking action, when channeled through trying to get retribution or justice, that's a very positive thing. It becomes a negative thing when you don't do anything about it and you just stay angry and you become bitter over time. But when you channel it towards a medium, like, for example, in the family's cases that I'm speaking about here, when you channel that anger towards public campaigns or through launching a civil case against the police department that's responsible, or lobbying the government, or galvanizing the public, as the George Floyd incident showed us, that's very productive forms of anger. So the issue with karma for me, and the issue of cosmic justice, is often it sucks this anger that we should feel, and it makes us content in being passive and letting things go that we really shouldn't let go, because they have knock-on negative effects in the long run. And right now, you know, there are so many things to be angry about with the Trump administration, and it honestly feels like they do something new every day that requires our anger for and action. One of those things is like the safety concerns around the aviation industry. We've seen that there's already been like 3 plane crashes since Trump came back into office. You had the plane crash in Philadelphia, you had the one in Washington, D.C., and then you recently had the one in Alaska. And all of these plane crashes are connected to direct government policy around the aviation industry, specifically its safety regulations. So during the Trump administration's first term, one of his policies was to move the safety regulation of the aviation industry from being done by an independent government body to being done by the aviation industry itself. And since that time, we have seen a degradation or a reduction in the safety of planes in general. So it has culminated in these 3 recent crashes. But even during his first term, we started seeing things like doors coming off during flights, or pieces of the plane falling off, or engines like suddenly going off mid-air. And all of these were pointing to the fact that the standards, the safety standards, had clearly been diminished. And now what's happening is that they've clearly undergone further degradations in terms of like the safety standards, if planes are starting to crash like every couple of weeks. That is definitely a focus of our anger, or should be a focus of our anger. We also have the disgusting immigration policies, where we've seen people, like, not only are they deporting people, but they're literally making it like a prime time, like, entertainment show, where they're recording people getting deported, and the way that these ICE officers and supporting officers are dressed, they're clearly designed to make it seem like an action film, almost feel like it's not real. And when you consider that the majority of these people who are being deported and treated in this way, like experiencing extreme violence, being seized from their families, being prevented from working, being detained, like all they've done is that they're undocumented. Like, most of the people are citizens who've been working for a long time, who pay their taxes, who are law-abiding citizens, and they're experiencing the kind of vilification and prosecution that you would expect like seasoned, hardened criminals to experience. Like, I'd understand if, for example, these were gangs that they were catching and they've been after them for a long time, and so this was like a rubbing your hands together because you're finally getting them. But these are like mothers and fathers and their children, their extended families, who've lived in the US for a very long time and whose only crime is that they're not documented. And when you consider that the United States itself is a population of immigrants by definition, although obviously the Republican Party are loath to acknowledge this, then why should one specific segment of the population be vilified in such a way? Literally 95% of the population probably is not native at all. And so again, this is another avenue where our anger should be directed there. We shouldn't be passive, we shouldn't be forgiving, we shouldn't turn the other eye or turn the other cheek, or have an expectation that cosmically or through divine order, people are going to get justice, or the people who are doing these bad things are going to be punished. Like, that day, as I said earlier, may never come. And actually, we should be even more vigilant right now and be even more active right now, because they've literally said that they're going to expand Guantanamo and make it into an immigration center. They've already started having beds there and started sending people there. And in practice, what that's going to mean is that it's going to be like a concentration camp. When you consider the kind of place that Guantanamo already is, the reason why they decided in the first place to have a facility like Guantanamo, and by the way, they have these all over the world, is because they wanted to avoid the the compound, if you will, from being subject to U.S. law. So the reason why they send people there, the people they kidnapped from Middle Eastern countries, like during the height of the Iraq war in the early 2000s, was that they could torture them without like fearing legal ramifications. And so the idea that they are going to ship immigrants, people they've seized from U.S. territories, to Guantanamo, which is obviously on Cuban territory, but is effectively in no man's land, is not subject to U.S. legislation, it means there's not going to be any human rights laws that apply. It means that they're not going to be entitled to trials. It means that they can treat them any way that they want to. They could treat them any way they want to physically. They can deprive them of food. They can deprive them of being like seeing and speaking with their families. We don't know what kinds of conditions they're going to be living under, but I guarantee you they're not going to be good. And we know they're not going to be good, because why would it, when the original foundation of that place was to torture thousands and thousands of people that were kidnapped from, as I say, Middle Eastern countries? When I say torture, like, obviously we know about the waterboarding that took place. It's also, and the sleep deprivation that took place, but it's also stuff like getting beaten for many hours of the day. It's getting cut. It's being sexually violated by men and women. It's like burning their prayer rugs in front of them and burning their religious texts in front of them. I read an account of like this disgusting woman who took her period blood and smeared it all over like this prisoner while she was giving him a lap dance. So it's a place where the sickest minds go, like the sickest minds are placed in positions of power here. They're the same people that are going to be standing guard over immigrants. So given that we don't have eyes in there, given what we know about Guantanamo already and what other people have faced, then it stands to reason that the people who are going to be shipped here are going to face the same fate. So again, as I say, like, the issue with karma for me is the passivity that it inspires in us. It makes us, one, like, not angry, because ultimately you believe that people are going to get what's coming to them eventually. And then secondly, it encourages us to put aside an anger that I really think, when it's directed towards the proper channels, when it's directed towards like activism and being engaged in your local politics and being engaged in doing something for other people who otherwise are helpless, I feel like that's a very productive form of anger. I spent a lot of time talking about karma in this episode, and I talked a little bit about like the concept of heaven and hell in terms of like cosmic justice. But one thing I didn't say earlier, which I think applies here, is that part of how we should judge whether we should follow something is based on the leader's behavior. So when I spoke about the Catholic Church, I kind of spoke about it in terms of like isolated instances of misbehavior. So for example, I talked about the Magdalen laundries in Ireland and how for a period of time they were the purveyors of like injustice against women. I also spoke about the instances of sexual predatoriness by priests and ministers and cardinals in the Catholic Church. And then I also spoke about their role in colonization and slavery. Like, taken together, in the context of how long the institution has existed, you could easily say that this is an example of like bad apples or like isolated instances. But I actually think that these things are endemic in the organization or in the infrastructure. And you can kind of tell this because you can tell that their leadership doesn't believe what they preach. A way that you can tell this is when you consider like some of the central tenets of Christianity that the Catholic Church, presumably as the center of Christian faith, should live by. One of those central tenets is the idea of being frugal or frugality. And that basically just means like not having more than you need, not being materialistic, not being like a hoarder of material wealth or material trappings. But when you look at the center of Christianity or the Christian faith, you will obviously look at the Vatican and the Vatican Church, and specifically how the Pope, as the representative or as the Prince of Jesus, he's supposed to be the representative of Jesus and God on earth. When you look at the way that he lives, and it's always a he, you will see that clearly they cannot believe in the tenet of frugality. Like, I watched this documentary like maybe 6 months ago, although I already kind of knew this anyway, and it, for the first time, had allowed cameras inside the Vatican, like unrestricted access, essentially. And they followed the Pope around as he like undertook his duties. And one of the biggest things that you cannot deny is the level of immense wealth that this man enjoys. So from like the church itself, it's like these massive high ceilings with like incredible artwork. When you look at his living quarters, it's like the stuff of dreams. It's like a king's, it is a palace. He lives in a palace, first of all. His living quarters, everything is like immaculate and expensive, like the finest sheets, like the finest furniture, the finest art. He literally sits on a gold throne. So when you see him like giving church, like giving mass on certain occasions, the seat that he sits on is literally gold. It's made of actual gold. When you look at the jewelry he wears, when you look at the crown that he wears, when you look at the clothes that he wears, everything is opulent. Everything is luxurious. Everything is lavish. And that's to say nothing of the immense wealth that the Vatican itself enjoys. The Vatican is home to the largest art collection in the world. It is home to the one of the biggest investment portfolios as well. They've got dealings in real estate, in art. They've got their hands in all kinds of pies. And so no matter how you slice and dice it, no matter how you look at it, like clearly they're not living out the way like the Christian faith requires them to live. Secondly, when you look at all the scandals that I spoke about in the episode earlier on, when you look at the sex scandals, they like took place at such a grand scale, like affecting like many, many countries, many towns, many cities, like thousands and thousands of children, hundreds and hundreds of priests themselves. It was literally endemic. And if it is endemic and it's being committed at such a high level and at such a high rate, it implies that the people themselves, the priests themselves that form the organization, must know something about how the organization truly functions. Because they say that when a fish rots, it rots from the head. And the idea being that when the head is rotten, the body will also obviously rot. So if like lower level priests are engaging at a wide scale in this kind of like perverted activity, it must mean that inside the organization, at the highest echelons of power within the Vatican or within the Catholic Church as an organization, that behavior must be endemic. It's kind of like how we hear all these stories of like white police officers, actually sometimes even black police officers, shooting like unarmed black people. And they do it at such a degree, at such a level, that it obviously tells you that they know that they can get away with it, that they're not going to be prosecuted or convicted, because the police departments most of the time will protect them from prosecution and from even having to release like evidence. Sometimes they'll erase the evidence, for example. And so again, like their behavior gives us an indication of what the institution really is like or really feels or really operates on the inside. And that's the same thing with like the Christian church or the Catholic church, the Roman Catholic church, in that if so many of its representatives are behaving in or engaging in this kind of like nefarious behavior at such a wide scale over such a prolonged period of time in such complex ways, and the organization always rallies around these predators, it must mean that that organization is rotten at its core. Otherwise, it would eject those quote unquote bad apples, and also that issue wouldn't be as widespread as it is. And so this is all to say that sometimes I feel like with these beliefs, like with the belief in karma, the belief in there being cosmic justice or divine justice that will be meted out to people by sending them either to heaven or hell based on their behavior, if they're being like propagated by organizations that clearly themselves don't believe in those values, it makes me feel like the only reason they peddle them to the masses is because it's an effective tool of control. So if people are afraid that there's like this omnipotent, omnipresent power in their lives that sees and hears everything bad that they do, then obviously it's going to incentivize them to like behave in a very particular way. But moreover, if they believe that there's going to be an afterlife in which bad people, for example, like these predator priests or, for example, these bad nuns, are going to be punished in the afterlife, then it kind of means that we are not, or we are less incentivized to hold them accountable in the here and now in this life. So it's all a bit too convenient to have a value system that is pushed onto people that rests on the notion that you shouldn't bother challenging injustices now or holding powerful organizations accountable, or to try and bring them down because they're going to be punished in the afterlife, or that divine justice is going to get them eventually. I think this is an incredibly disempowering message, regardless of how it initially reads. Because when you initially think about it, you're like, oh yeah, you know, like something bad is going to happen to people who do bad things. But because we have everyday reminders that that isn't true, that our enemies, as I said at the beginning of the episode, are still thriving, villains are still thriving, they get to enjoy the spoils of their villainry, that's a word, or villainy, for a lifetime. They get to transform it into generational wealth and generational power. Because we know that that's what's happening in real life, it's never that satisfying, because we ultimately know or suspect or feel deep down that karma probably isn't real and that people don't always get punished for the bad things that they do. And so what I think is personally a better or more empowering message, or a message that feels good, is the idea of making ourselves the karma. And by that I mean like taking action and being active in like righting the wrongs in our lives and in taking justice for ourselves and for others. And that can look very different depending on the context. On a personal level, it might mean like, for example, like one of the things I think about women when they go through divorces, especially when they're coming from abusive relationships or relationships where their male partners were particularly heinous or bad, is that they often kind of like turn the other cheek and say basically that the man can have everything. He can keep the house, he can keep the family wealth, or the family assets, and he can go off and start a new life. And while I think it's good to forgive in certain contexts, especially if there's nothing you can do about it, I often feel like there is something you can do about it. Like you probably are going to feel better in terms of your own self-worth and self-esteem and feelings of empowerment by like bringing karma on that person, by taking them to court, for example, and getting what you rightfully deserve, or not allowing them to be a deadbeat parent who gets to waltz into your children's life having not contributed anything socially or financially. I feel like believing in karma sometimes, again, as I said, like drains the anger that can fuel you into taking action that actually does make you feel empowered and feel like you're in a better position for yourself. And by the way, as a caveat, I'm not referring to like physically abusive relationships. Like that's a completely different kettle of fish. From the little that I know that the dynamics are very different and can result in real safety issues. So I'm only applying this to just like regular bad relationships where it's like an unfaithful partner who breaks up a relationship, or who's selfish, or who otherwise just isn't a good partner but isn't a dangerous person. Outside the personal sphere, another way that I feel we can be the karma or the people that right the wrongs of society is in the political domain. One of the things I think about often when I see like what's happening within the US administration and some of the representatives is I think they are so fearless. They are so content and satisfied that we are not going to take any action, that we feel powerless, that there is no consequences to their action, that they're actually becoming increasingly like evil by the day. So when you have people like Elon Musk like get on TV and do the Nazi salute in front of millions of people, that's because he knows that there's not going to be any consequences to his actions. It's basically a massive middle finger to the masses, to us the population, and it's him telling us that he believes that he is untouchable and can do anything. Or for example, when we see literal sexual predators and rapists, like confirmed rapists like Donald Trump, make it all the way into office despite the fact that they have a sexual conviction, like a sexual violence conviction, the fact that he was heavily connected to Jeffrey Epstein, the fact that we know all kinds of sexually unsavory things about him, but he still makes it to the highest office in the land, tells you again that they clearly believe that they are untouchable. They clearly themselves don't believe in karma. And when they can start like proposing actual concentration camps, as they are when they're talking about Guantanamo, and they're talking about how they're going to ship people there and how the terrible conditions they're going to live under. Again, these are people who are telling us they feel like they are the kings of the world. They feel like there is no karma to be had, no negative consequences to their actions. And I think the way that we can use active karma or engaged karma or non-passive karma is by us being that karma, about us being the people who mobilize collectively and individually to take them down a few pegs, either because we show up to these rallies. I mean, I don't live in the US, so I'm not participating, but show up to marches and rallies, vote in a different way, be engaged with your local politics and with your local representatives to hold them accountable, to make them hold the administration to account. Using your money and your dollar or your pound or whatever it is to make consumer choices that hold these people and their companies to account. So one of the things that brings me great satisfaction is how much the Tesla sales have fallen. So I was reading about how in Norway and Sweden and Germany and Spain and France, like, demand for their cars has gone down by as much as 60% in some places. I think it was 59% in Germany. And so that's an example of people using their anger, like, productively, using their disdain productively, like, not sitting on their hands and waiting for, like, fate to change things or being passive in the lives of other people. It's them taking action the way that they are able and making their money speak for them. So that's an example of being engaged and being the karma, if you will, that rights some of these wrongs. And honestly, when you look around, there's so much activism taking place. There's so many examples of people using their money or their consumer choices or their time or their platforms or their resources to make a difference. And so as long as we are not using the idea of karma or the idea of cosmic justice or the idea that people are going to be penalized or punished in the afterlife as an excuse not to do anything about the here and now, and is an excuse to not do anything to improve the lives of our community and other people around us in the here and now, then that's fine. But if that is what's happening, then obviously that's not so good. So with that, I'm going to wrap up this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you were able to get some value from it, and I hope you were able to listen to the very end. If you did like the episode, I would love it if you left me a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts from, just because it helps with the algorithm and helps people find the podcast easier. I'll be back next Monday as usual. Until then, have a great week, and I'll speak to you then.